Okay, cool.
Good afternoon, comrades. Welcome to our regular Sunday discussion group hosted by the Consistent Democrats. Today we're going to have a talk on the environment and the threat to the biosphere. I hope that's the right title. Dan is going to give us a talk, and then once you've finished, I will open it up for questions and answers and contributions. So, Dana, come on, Dana, the floor is yours. Take it away.
Oh, okay, where do I take it? Ah, there. Right, okay. Oh, excuse me. The title's Capitalism, the Environment. I suppose briefly, ought to say a bit about how capitalism works and Marx and the ecology. Marx was very much into ecology, much, and he got became more so later in life. One of the things that he noted was the oh God, what's the term? The I'll write it down now. That you've got people living in the country and people living in cities and towns. Through the with capitalism, people were steadily cleared off the country, so that you just had a small number cultivating land. Metabolic rift—that was the term I was looking for. So you'd have a small number of people cultivating land, and then the food produced on the land would go to feed people in the towns and cities. And then the output from the people would go straight into the local environment, waterways, River Thames, and stuff, instead of back onto the land. So that meant that the land was gradually being depleted, and instead of being re-fertilized from the excrement from the people. Also, Britain was importing guano. I think that was came from Chile's coast. That was used as fertilizer, but it ran out. As for how capitalism works, it depends on growth. It depends on surplus labor, and it depends expropriating labor and nature. The natural world, and doesn't take into account that humans are a part of the natural world. They're treated as separate. And as you and capitalism is constantly driving to more profits, constantly producing more and more stuff more cheaply, more profitably, and depriving people, and that also deprives people of the ability to buy the stuff. It also creates the people wealthy prats who profit from the production. They're profiting from the production the labor and resources. While the labor can't buy the stuff they're producing, and it's so that it's in a constant cycling to a constant state of crises. I don't think my explanation is very clear. I hadn't got round to writing that bit. So starting off with climate change, because we've got a problem that, which with a lot of people who claim to be on the left, are climate change deniers, because, well, I'll just read what I've written. The Earth's climate was changing for millennia before humans evolved as a species. Historically, changes in the Earth's temperature and the composition of its atmosphere in response to the evolution of primitive life forms have enabled the evolution of life as we know it on the planet. And we've got anthropogenic climate change. The Earth's climate has always been changing. Complexity of climate system and modeling, changing weather patterns not clearly conclusive, lack of direct experience in prominent locations, alleged lack of evidence, corporations profiting from greenwashing scams, all of these are used as a justification for anthropogenic climate change denial. And so we've got Picky. I think everybody saw the Picky. So do you want to see the Picky again, or are you convinced by it? Oh, okay, I'll show you.
Could you put the pick on again, because we've had a few late arrivals,
Yeah,
so
we should put one.
have we? Because I haven't. All right, what am I doing? Right, stop sharing. And Picky. Yeah, that's a picky of how the temperature, the total sort of Earth temperature has increased since 1940, from 1940 up to 2024, which is the last complete year we've had. And last year, the temperature, the Earth's temperature overshot the 1.5 degree C limit that the IPCC agrees as agreed as high as we can go without being in more danger. That looks fairly conclusively exponential to me, and I think it probably does to most people. So everyone's had a lot of chance to see it. I will go back to text. Where am I? The Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, abbreviated to AMOC, is at risk of breakdown. It includes the Gulf Stream, which keeps the climate of the British Isles, Ireland, northwestern Europe warmer than regions at a comparable latitude would be without it. AMOC funnels heat northwards through the Atlantic Ocean. It's crucial for controlling climate and marine ecosystems, weaker than at any time in the past 1,000 years. Modeling suggests recent weakening can be explained by taking into account meltwater from Greenland ice sheet and the Canadian glaciers. If the Gulf Stream collapses as a result of global warming, our climate will become life-threateningly colder. Global warming projected to be greater than 1.5 degrees C within a few years. The Picky looks like it reached it. Putting humanity in danger, multiple climate tipping points causing catastrophic risk to billions of people. Tropical coral reefs have crossed tipping point with unprecedented dieback. The Amazon rainforest risks widespread dieback, on climate change and deforestation. And I was given an example of to support supporting evidence for anthropogenic climate change, because people, in spite of some of the weird weather we've had and wildfires and all the rest of it, still denying that there's any it's got anything to do with climate change, but there are parts of the world where that where people living there can't miss it. Chart include it. Oh, I have shown that chart. Okay. The annual global temperature anomalies relative to 1850 to 1900. Provisional estimate for 2024 based on 10 months. I can show the picture again. That was the text that goes with it. Where has it gone? So that 1.5 degrees centigrade for last year is an estimate. I'll go back to next. Where am I? So that picky shows global temperature increasing exponentially in response to an exponential increase in greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. Polar ice melt retreat, glacial melting, glacier retreat. Examples, parts of the Indian subcontinent and its river systems dependent on seasonal glacial melting retreat and refreezing for water source. Long-established human settlements depend on this water source. Massive increase in great glacial melting retreat causing flooding and devastating landslides. Causing devastation and destruction of village settlements. People in those settlements, for example, in Pakistan, are directly experiencing the devastation of climate change. They know climate change is real. Fastest melting glaciers include those in Alaska, Iceland, the Alps. A profound effect on glaciers in the Pamir Mountains, the Hindu Kush, and Himalayas. Corporate greenwashing scams. Carbon credits, carbon offsetting is a greenwashing scam. I'll just read what I've written. November 2023, prior to COP28 summit in Dubai, UAE firm Blue Carbon, owned by Sheikh Ahmed Al Maktoum, set up carbon offset Ponzi scheme using control of vast tracts of African land. Carbon offsetting greenwashing scam is a Ponzi scheme for buying and selling carbon credits, enabling corporate fossil fuel producers and users to buy carbon credits instead of reducing their greenhouse gas emitting activities. Buying carbon credits pays for forested land while the buyer continues their commercial activities generating greenhouse gases. But the forests can't absorb the greenhouse gases at a timescale that offsets them. While some of the forests used are actually lost to forest fires, often caused by global warming. The forests used this way are commonly taken from indigenous populations, whose governments are coerced into selling the land as a way of paying off debts that they should never have been conned into taking on in the first place. Carbon credits and offsetting is a scam which entrenches and enables the increase in global greenhouse gas emissions. that doesn't just affect poor, low-income countries such as those in Africa, but we have that same scam used here, as some of the corporations are buying farmland that comes onto the market in Wales, and local farmers in Wales or local would-be farmers in Wales are priced out of getting that land for farming it because the people paying for it with the carbon net offsetting scam have more money, and they can outprice local would-be farmers. And then they'll the theory is that that land is then planted with forest, but it won't be like indigenous forest, which is either already there or reestablishes itself naturally, which will be more efficient at actually absorbing carbon dioxide. And that there's no guarantee that those forests will last. War weapons manufacture, weapons trade. War and its profits are an essential part of maintaining the contradictory, unstable capitalist system. War and weapons are the greatest source of greenhouse gas emissions. West militaries and arms makers are growing richer each year, producing massive profits for the corporate arms manufacturer, their CEOs and the shareholders. Oh, I think I misread that. The arms manufacturers are growing, so that's economic growth through profiting to make money for manufacturers, CEOs, and shareholders. Military emissions are at an all-time high. COP UN conferences repeatedly fail to hold military industrial complex accountable for its emissions. The military needs to be held accountable for radioactive contamination from nuclear energy. For COP28, there are no documents mention military and war contribution to climate crisis. Those all these military greenhouse gas emissions are always totally excluded from all of those COP thingy conferences. Environmental impact of NATO's proxy war in Ukraine. Blowing up Nord Stream pipeline, we released massive amount of methane, a more potent greenhouse gas than CO2, into the atmosphere. Use of depleted uranium supplied by Britain in new munition. Land littered with landmines. Disruption and pollution of water supplies. Land polluted by collapse of the hydro dam system on the Dnieper River. In wars generally, land is contaminated by chemical weapons and defoliants. For example, the use of Agent Orange as a defoliant in Vietnam, which decades later has left land contaminated, people still being poisoned, including babies being born with defects. Environmental cost of the super rich. Capitalism relentlessly concentrates disproportionate levels of wealth into the hands of a minority, creating a global class of super wealthy individuals detached from the appreciation of the world, real world. An Oxfam report in October 2024 reveals in 1 year, one ultra-rich European takes an average of 140 flights, spends 260 hours in the 67 hours in the air, emits as much carbon as an average European in 112 years. In 1 year, a super yacht user emits as much carbon as an ordinary European would in 585 years. Less than a week. Excuse me. Less than a week of emissions from the super yachts and jets of one of the 31 of the richest people in the EU exceeded the entire lifetime emissions of a person in the world's poorest 1%. 50 of the world's richest billionaires, on average, emit more carbon through their investments, private jets, and yachts in just over 1.5 hours than an average person in a lifetime. Nearly 40% of billionaire investments are in highly polluting industries: oil, mining, shipping, and cement. The total investment emissions of 36 of the EU's richest billionaires are equivalent to the annual emissions of over 4.5 million Europeans. Environmental cost of Gaza genocide. The UN Environmental Programme, UNEP, assesses unprecedented environmental impact of war in Gaza. Rapidly growing soil, water, and air pollution risks irreversible damage to Gaza's natural ecosystems. In the first 2 months of the Gaza War, carbon emissions were greater than the annual carbon footprint of more than 20 of the world's most climate-vulnerable nations. Gaza reconstruction is estimated to generate approximately 60 million tons of CO2, more than the annual emissions of more than 135 countries. Health effects of air pollution. Exposure to fossil fuel air pollution increases the risk of strokes, heart and lung disease, cancer, etc., causing 8.7 million premature deaths per year, equivalent to nearly one-fifth of deaths worldwide. Exposure to fine particulate matter, PM2.5, from burning fossil fuels led to 8.7 million deaths in 2018. Air pollution is an invisible killer, a particular risk to children, elderly, people on low incomes. People in urban areas suffer the worst impacts. PM2.5 is equivalent to airborne particles less than 2.5 microns in diameter, especially dangerous to young children whose organs and immune response are developing. Food systems and agribusiness. Much of our food system is increasingly global and industrialized. This includes industrialized fishing in the form of large trawlers scraping the seabed, leading to overfishing for profit, depleting fish stocks, indiscriminate catching of non-target species, damage to marine ecosystems. Industrial farmed fish is unsafe to eat, such as salmon, bred for maximum profit. Fed an unbalanced diet, including seafood, has a dense population leading to disease, infecting the marine environment, and treated with toxic chemicals. Farmed fish is a hazard to local wild fish and the marine environment. Industrial farming produces monocrops using chemical inputs in the form of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, leading to depleted soil erosion, contamination, and damage to ecosystems. Loss of biodiversity, including pollinators and natural predators to pests that damage crops. Loss of soil structure and microorganisms that plants need for healthy growth and nutrition. That's both nutrition of the plants and nutrition of the people eating them. Runoff of excess fertilizers and slurry from intensively farmed animals pollutes rivers and water sources. Industrial livestock farming uses imported animal feed, industrially grown as large monocrops, mainly GM soya and GM maize, mostly grown in Brazil and Argentina, largely on deforested land contaminated with pesticides. GM soya is engineered to be herbicide resistant, poisons vast tracts of agricultural land and surrounding areas with herbicides such as glyphosate. Poisons the environment, ecocidal, poisonous to local residents, particularly damaging in large parts of Argentina. Land is expropriated from indigenous populations in low-income countries, for example, parts of Africa such as Kenya, for growing food in the form of cash crops for export to richer countries such as Britain. International food systems produce trade via polluting shipping, emitting greenhouse gases, endangering marine life from noise pollution and collisions. Globally and in the UK, land and food production is increasingly taken over by transnational corporate agribusiness. Business. Land misuse in Britain. Wealthy British landowners, especially the royal family and aristocracy, use vast tracts of land to profit from shooting game birds such as grouse and partridge. Much of this land is moorland, including peatlands, mismanaged with breeding unnaturally large numbers of birds and destroying the natural ecosystems, native wildlife, and biodiversity by seasonally burning natural vegetation to accommodate the bred birds and the ability to kill them easily in large numbers. In 2024, approximately 150 grouse moor estates covered 550,000 acres in England. 300 grouse estates covered 2 million acres in the Scottish Highlands. There's large amounts of land under golf courses. In Surrey, about 2.65%. More than has houses on it. Two times more, twice as much land used for golf courses than for housing in England. Trump's golf course in Aberdeenshire destroyed a site of special scientific interest on the coast. And that's as far as I got, I'm afraid. So that didn't cover as much as I would have liked it to, because I didn't manage to complete it all.
Okay, thank Diana, that was very extensive. So, are you happy to take questions and contributions?
Yes.
Okay, so comrades, I remind you that the meeting had been recorded, so if you can indicate with your virtual hand if possible, and if you're on camera, just raise your physical hand and as I'll be able to see you, and then I'll call you as I see you, who would like to start?
What?
Ian.
I'll just say a couple of things. I mean, I thought that was very good, and there's a lot of stuff I didn't know about in that. So not in terms of the broad brush of it, but in terms of the fine grained details. The stuff about grouse wars, for instance, and the fact that there's actually, what you said, there was 500,000 acres in England of grouse wars, but 2.5 million acres in the Highlands of Scotland. That's astonishing, actually. I mean, it's probably because it shows my ignorance of the nature of Scotland and its detailed makeup. But that is really astonishing, the amount of land that's simply put at one side for the amusements of the idle rich, really, that could be used for other much more productive purposes to benefit the whole population. I mean, I, that stuff might be peripheral to the question of climate change, you could argue, but it nevertheless it does show the mentality of the wealthy and of the capitalist system in producing a whole swathes of the countryside put aside for their personal amusement, really. There's nobody, it's grouse shooting. My God, that is an elite sport, if there ever was one, so-called sport, an elite occupation of killing birds for fun, that's just one thing that springs to mind. But I think there's the stuff about golf courses, this is all very interesting, but I think the overall question of the war machine, that's also dealt with very, very, very much, and I think that really needs a good exploration. Because I think all this stuff needs a good exploration, and I think Diana's notes are obviously very fragmentary and of use in this presentation, but they could be written up into something quite synthetic that we could actually put out as an article to sum up. Because it does actually provide a weapon. We are not deniers of this stuff. And some of those on the who we have sort of similar views on some questions with, like Ukraine or whatever, have nevertheless skeptical. Like I'm talking particularly of Galloway's party, for instance, have skeptical views on the climate and play it down or appear to do. But I don't think it's really feasible. It's People are suffering even now because of the heat in England from these heat waves, let alone in other parts of the world where where temperatures are going through the roof. They're not all the time, but at some times you get these peaks of temperature in places that I've got family in the Philippines. Fucking things heading up towards 50 degrees sporadically at the moment. That is what's happening, and it's, never mind the Middle East and places like this. I mean, even in the Palestinian, genocide is going on, but people are actually suffering in 50 degrees heat there as well, as well as the genocide. It's a threat to life and limb in itself. What capitalism is doing to the climate. So I think it is important that we get this stuff down and we get a decent, this is the making of a decent article, I think. We can probably put it, we can write it up into something more readable in the next few weeks before we bring the journal out. So I think that'd be a very good it'd be very good to have that in the journal anyway. I'll leave it there for now. Thanks.
Anyone else? Oh, sorry, Danny, did you want to come back on any of that?
Yes, if I can do that, if I leave it, I'll probably forget, lose track. There is an environmental aspect to those grouse moors. A lot of them are on peatlands, and when you dig up peat or burn it off, peat is a store of stored methane gas. So if you destroy those peatlands, you're releasing the methane gas into the atmosphere. That's a greenhouse gas. And the way the landowners basically trash them to sort of make it easier to provide loads of birds to kill, is also destroying biodiversity. It's destroying the natural habitat. The other point about burning those moors is that by destroying the natural vegetation, they stop absorbing. Well, they're destroying the natural vegetation increases the flooding after rainfall from onto land sort of downstream. So they absorb, if left naturally, they absorb water from rain, and then the land further down doesn't is less likely to be flooded, and the rivers that feed from them will be fed more regular, less destructive rate. So they are what's happening there is environmentally important. I can't remember what I was going to do. Anyway, I'll do.
Okay, I'll bring the next constituent. Mark, hey. No, sorry, Susan, one moment, please.
Susan has arrived.
I'll take Mark A first, and then I'll bring Susan in.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Just a quick one. Diana, you mentioned early on about the poles, the Arctic and Antarctic, and the effect that capitalism is having on there. Taking into account that capitalists put the interests of capitalism first, as you say, do ministers take in the UK and Europe take any notice at all about what's happening at the polls? Because that seems, if you don't know a lot about the subject, they seem the clearest manifestation of what's going wrong. And so I guess what I'm saying is, do they listen to scientists when it comes to the rising temperature of the poles and the effect it's having on the sea levels? What do you think about that?
Probably not. I don't get you. Think about what the government's doing. I mean, I didn't cover nearly as much stuff as I intended, so I would have covered policy, but certainly policy in Britain when it comes to the environment is absolutely dire. They sort of they pay all lip service to net, you know, they use all these terms like net zero and all the rest of the stuff. But when it comes to doing anything actually real, they just do what their corporate puppet masters tell them to do.
Sure.
And the wealthy bums who have the power to have the say on policy are just not living in the real world. They don't. They've got a weird mindset. They're just odd.
Indeed. Okay. Thanks.
Susan.
Yeah, I added to the chat some of the information about the damage that grouse moults do. But in addition to that, they're used for tax breaks. There were Guardian articles going back to 2004. Only 335 landowners own all of those millions of square kilometres that the acreage that Diane is talking about, and not to mention the grotesque way in which the people, the keepers who keep grouse moors, poison raptors, kill wildlife, and the whole, as you say, the whole burning of it. Grouse moors would naturally revert to woodland in Scotland and other places, and they would be a reasonable ecosystem. What they are never allowed to do is this pretense that somehow grouse moors are heritage simply because a few rich people had them as you say, entertainment, but we actually subsidise them for the privilege of them having those grouse moors, and then have the gall to try and pretend that we must keep them for tourism purposes to encourage, you know, visitors to continue to do it. But and the same is true of the golf courses, I'm afraid. So, yeah, backing it up. As far as the, I'm sorry, apologies that I missed the bit on the polls. We shouldn't underestimate the extent to which the financial interests dictate whether or not certain areas of the world are exploited. Russia has obviously spent a lot of money on icebreakers to keep the North Passage going, and that would reduce the amount of fuel being used to transport trade around the world by some 40%. It would also reduce the amount of pollution. But because, of course, it is controlled by Russia, it must be bad, and we must stop using it, and we must not, you know, it must not be allowed to benefit Russia. But the whole point about a lot of transport is it would be far better if it was used by land corridors that were allowed freely to operate and would use the most efficient systems, whether that's, you know, rivers and canals, or whether it's railways, or whether it is by sea. But the most important thing is that it should be about world trade for everybody, and in particular for the global south, and not this ludicrous, world police that the American empire, or the empire of the West, tries to control and abuse the system so that it can extract the maximum profit at the various choke points that they have identified, and in particular regime change in order to monopolize certain areas of the world, like the Suez Canal, Panama Canal, in particular, of course, the Ben-Gurion Canal that they would like to establish in Israel, having once they have got control of the Middle East. So politics comes into this, is what I'm trying to say. And I apologize that I wasn't here when you were talking about the polls. Yeah. But we have to have a global system that actually looks at what does the least environmental damage for the whole planet. And maybe for my money, it ought to be under the auspices of the UN, with no veto for the winners of World War II, i.e., UK, France, America, or Russia or China, but it should have no veto by any one continent or country to stop what should be for the benefit of all.
Yeah.
Does that fit in with what you were trying to what you were talking about, Diana.
Yes, it does. It fits in with the stuff I left out. But it also... I'm glad you mentioned all that stuff, because it's...
Well, I know we've talked about it before, and you've done, you know, I know you do an amazing job with the work that you do, but, you know, we asked you a huge task, if you don't mind you saying so, and I'm glad you embraced it with some enthusiasm.
Well, I don't know about this enthusiasm. I did try. But when mentioning canals, that reminds me of... a bit about canals that I was going to include and forgot about, the Panama Canal,
yes,
which is an environmental disaster because of its design, because it depends on a system of locks, and it uses the locks get filled with fresh water from the land, which effectively gets sort of wasted into the sea. And as the traffic has increased and the climate has changed, so that the water supply on the land is less reliable, that water loss has become more damaging. And the other thing is, why do we need those big ships anyway?
Well,
I mean, okay, we need, you know, trade is useful, genuinely, but not the massive shipping going all around the world six times every bloody direction.
Well, the real...
hang on a minute. Remember, this meeting has been recorded, so let's not have too much to unfold. Is there anyone else that wants to contribute?
Yes, I would add to what Diana's been saying. The Chinese are talking about building a more practical canal and allowing the Panama Canal to be used for only smaller ships that are actually going that, you know, that would benefit from it. And that would make far more sense. But again, the Americans are squatting on the, if we're not controlling it, we won't allow it to be built. I forget, isn't it in Nicaragua that they are planning to put a deeper canal that would allow the biggest ships, which again would be more efficient, but it would ensure the trade was spread out more fairly. Because, as you say, canals require fresh water to end up being dumped into the sea, which means it's not doing the job of irrigating the land on its way to the sea. That's the whole point of how rivers do benefit, you know, the whole ecosystem. Yep, so while canals do a great thing for transport, they don't do as much for actually allowing the water to spread through the land and do it, you know, fresh water is only, I forget, is it 3% of the total water on the planet?
Diana, and then Ian.
There has been a canal planned for Nicaragua for several years, but it's controversial. I think some people in Nicaragua want it. It will, you know, it will bring an income, get the trade going through there, and some people don't like the idea because of the environmental implications, that it might be environmentally damaging. So as I'm not in Nicaragua and I don't have enough knowledge about it, I don't have a fixed view. I mean, I would be rather inclined to think, well, why do we need the big ships anyway? But, you know, but that's just me.
Ian. You moved to Ian.
I just noticed. Yeah. I mean, just on that, what I know about Nicaragua is there's some rather large lakes in Nicaragua for such a small country, if I remember rightly. And that could be both what they're planning to make use of, and also that would be a potential threat to the environment in that area. you know, if you start messing with large lakes and things, you know. And it is a small, very, you know, it's an isthmus, isn't it? The whole of Central America really is a thin piece of land. And it strikes me that there could be other ways of doing this, like some sort of relay system or something, because the land distance is not huge to cross, you know. And obviously you're trying to get round the problem of this piece of land being in the way of between two huge oceans. There must be more rational ways of doing such things. But maybe that's not profitable. I don't know. But what was the other thing I was going to say? No, I'll leave it there. I'll leave it there. Okay, thanks.
Danny, did you want to come back on any of that?
No, I think Ian and Susan between them probably said more than me anyway.
Okay. Does anyone else want to say anything? I've got a contribution I'd like to make if no one else wants to say anything. And that is, Dana, I need to join your presentation. You'll know that a subject close to my heart within the environment is challenging the idea that overpopulation is somehow the problem. I think the idea that overpopulation is the problem is just not true. And in your talk, I've noticed that you talked about the amount of pollution actually caused by the WIC, you know, the wealthy, the carbon footprint created by the top, by the richest people in the world, and that needs to be remembered, that they have a carbon footprint that far exceeds what the general population uses, I would argue, and I think many environmental campaigns was to challenge this Malthusian view that overpopulation is the problem, have mentioned that over the years. I believe somebody that you introduced me to, a guy called Ian Angus, made a point in a speech, a talk he gave in, I think it was 1996, where he mentioned that he put it rather crudely, but he said you could wipe out vast quantities of the population of Africa, and it would make no difference to the carbon footprint, because the carbon footprint produced by the top 10 corporations at that time was far more than the population of those areas would produce. I'll stop there, thanks. And then Susan wants to come in, if Diana wants to come back on any of that.
No, I don't think so.
Okay,
Susan.
Well, I would back you up. I think I think individual people should be assessed for their carbon footprint, if you like, that it's lifestyles. You cannot compare how much environmental damage a billionaire does compared with, you know, even a normal person in their particular country. But you certainly can't compare, you know, I am absolutely certain that the 4,000 or so multimillionaires that, you know, sorry, billionaires that there are in the world use up far greater percentage of the environment than 50% of the population of the world. So no, I agree with you, Paul. We do not have overpopulation, and you can see that from the fact that, you know, in a great many rich countries, a third of the food that is imported or grown is actually wasted just simply by dint of, you know, sell-by dates and failure to actually eat what they consume. And they consume out of, you know, it is also the fact that it is wages that prevent a great many people from having the food and calories that they need to live properly. But above all, it is the waste of, you know, the military spending that prevents us from having a decent, sustainable lifestyle. And the impact that that makes on our environment only makes that much, much worse. And apologies again, I'm guessing that you started with how much environmental damage the obsession with military spending that the West has, not just on the fact that it pollutes the environment from depleted uranium through to munitions and mines that make the land dangerous for agriculture for decades, if not centuries, but that actually it prevents, you know, it actually pollutes the environment with the sheer amount of fuel and munitions, you know, the actual damage that it does to the environment where people fight and use arms.
Diana, do you want to come back on any of that?
Yeah, I did. I did include stuff about that, about the greenhouse gas emissions from war and weapons, and the environmental damage where war takes place. I don't know when you came in, and I can't remember what order I did everything in there.
But it will be on the recording, so Ian will release that fairly quickly, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Ian, do you want to come in?
I knew there was something I'd forgotten to say earlier on, and it's this. It's what Susan said about the United Nations and how we need to get rid of the vetoes of the various major powers and things like that. I think that's not realistic under capitalism. The whole point of the every world system that existed under capitalism has always had the major imperialist powers or sometimes their adversaries as well have managed to force their way into things. There's always been a way that the imperialists will try to control any international system. And I think it really is, you know, we need to advocate an international planning mechanism and an international socialist planned economy, really. You know, the only way this problem can be dealt with is through socialism and through on an international scale, not on a national scale, or not even on the sum of various different national scales, because this problem is universal. It affects the whole of humanity, and therefore logically there has to be a body, and we have to advocate it, even if it seems like pie in the sky at the moment. There has to be a body that plans the allocation and use of natural resources in a rational and sustainable manner for the future. And that is some sort of international planning body that is explicitly has the mandate of to carry out a socialist way of doing things, to actually plan things for human need and not for profit, in other words. That has to be a worldwide sort of program to advocate that. So that's what I was really going to say earlier on, except it slipped my mind, so I'll say it now. Thanks.
Susan.
Yeah, the other thing is that we must stop this rich countries buying their way out of pollution mm-hmm. by the fantasies of, you know, carbon capture or carbon swapping, or, you know, the idea that some billionaire can buy up vast tracts of the Congo or, you know, the Amazonian rainforest and then not allow the people there to develop it in a way that suits the needs of the indigenous people, while secretly allowing, you know, miners to come in and pollute the environment with mercury because there happens to be a little gold there, or there we are overlooking and not making people accountable for crimes. It's quite clear from the way that Africa, many of the national parks are now managing the work, you know, to live with their wildlife, while in Britain we're still killing badgers and foxes for entertainment or on the fantasy that somehow, you know, badgers are responsible for contaminating cattle and interfering with, you know, the price of cows. Yeah, but it's the TB fantasy. We are not treating, you know, we do not regard other people's responsibilities to the environment. And while we are busy pointing the finger elsewhere at how they should manage their environment, but we are not doing the same at home.
Mm-hmm.
So I get very cross with the whole killing animals for entertainment that goes on.
In the in Ghana talk, he did he did cover the whole briefly point about carbon trading, or what he called carbon credits. So that
yep.
briefly touches on the initial part of what you were saying, wouldn't it? So
but it's. Yeah, it's that thinking that rich countries can buy their way out of their pollution, in specifically on those two areas, both, as you say, carbon trading and selling our waste and our pollution literally to other countries. Thank goodness Africa in particular countries are no longer accepting plastic waste and other things. Thank you.
Does anyone else want to come in before I come back in?
No.
Go on, Diana.
Yeah, I was just going to... I have trouble remembering both Susan and Ian. But Ian makes very, very good point about needing the international planning, and what that reminded me of was before NATO's proxy war against Russia started, British scientists, I'm not sure if it was only British scientists, but at least there were some British scientists, were working with Russian scientists looking at the boreal forests, I think in northern bit of Siberia, that are they're on frozen land, and they were doing research on and investigation into the thawing of that land. But as soon as that sodding war started, Russians and British scientists mustn't talk to Russians, who can't have them working together. So that project just got dropped, which was a tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only bit I was going to come back on, for now anyway, was I mentioned earlier about the point about overpopulation. Mm-hmm. And why that needs to be challenged. But also one of the other reasons that I forgot to mention that it needs to be challenged. Both Martin Empson and Ian Angus have also said in talks that they, both of them, have given in the past that a lot of the overpopulation argument, often followed by many on the left, is there's an undercurrent of racism there that people don't initially see that there's there. Their argument is basically that it's like political code for saying that there's too many black or too many Asian people. That was the other point about why the overpopulation needs to be challenged. Thanks. Does anyone else want to come back in?
Sorry, I got my hands full. Apologies, I'll wait till after Jonathan.
Afternoon, Jonathan, go ahead.
All right, hello everyone. Interesting talk, I think. You know, I thought it was an interesting talk. I'm not really up on the environment and that, but I do know that the one thing is the climate deniers, for some reason, they don't really wind me up. I don't know why, but they don't sort of, doesn't spark a thing with me. I mean, I don't, you know, I think we should, you know, I think they should be allowed to have their point of view. And but I don't, I, you know, it doesn't sort of rile me that they are climate deniers. I mean, interestingly, one was a taxi driver and the other bloke, yeah, they were both taxi drivers over the past couple of years. And both of them said to me they're sceptics about global warming, right? And I said to my friend, you know, as far as these theories go, and I said, you know, why don't you ever get into a taxi driver and they say to you, why, you know, do you think the match at the weekend was fixed, right? Because there's quite a bit of empirical evidence to now say that match fixing in sport is widespread. And so why do they fixate on this on this climate that they're skeptical about the climate change thing? But you never hear people come out and say, you know, don't you think there was the sport might have been fixed for the weekend or this? And I asked a couple of people why they thought this was the case, that that match fixing was never brought up. And they said, because one of them said it isn't shadowy enough. The whole thing about conspiracy theories about climate change and that involve elites and liberal elites and that sort of thing. And but you know, it's concocted by a liberal elite. But the match fixing isn't shadowy enough to capture people's imagination and conspiracy theories. Although in the case of match fixing, there's quite a lot of evidence that it goes on.
Interesting. Yeah.
Ernie, do you want to come back on any of that?
I don't know. To be honest, my attitude towards sport is such that I really don't care whether matches are fixed or not. Maybe there are a few circumstances where they actually matter to people. But when it comes to environmental devastation, that is serious. And there is a thing that this claim that somehow worrying about the environment and climate change is all about is an interest in that ordinary poverty-stricken people aren't affected by, whereas of course it's the poorest people, the most vulnerable people on the planet, who are affected most by environmental problems, whether it's climate change or pollution or whatever it is. The thing about people in denying in climate change denial, sort of say, trying to have arguments with them, saying, "Oh no, it's wrong," or "It's all right. You know, everybody has a right to their belief." It's not about belief. It's about scientific evidence and trying to find ways of communicating that evidence to them, to inform them, not to have a sort of stand up sort of argument coming to blows with them, if you see what I mean. That's what I was put in that presentation, was trying to address, but it probably needs improving.
Yeah, the only thing I would personally say before I bring anybody else in on that is that, well, Jonathan will come back later, but one could argue that actually, if you're a taxi driver, depending on the nature of the vehicle you're using, you could argue that they have a material basis in their current circumstance by trying to turn out that it's happening. So there's a vested interest there, if you like, depending on the nature of the vehicle that they're using. Susan, Ian, and then Jonathan again.
Okay. I would agree with you. The first people to identify climate change and really highlight it goes back to the very early, the late 1900s, the very beginning of the 1900s. People like Jack London were writing about how the noticeable changes in places like Yellowstone Park, in the, Jack Wild popularized, I read Call of the Wild and the rest of it in my childhood, and remembered what he was writing about. And there is extensive documentation from the big petrol, the big oil companies, Exxon and Shell and others, who were spending literal fortunes. And the only way I can compare it to is they were spending money to lie about the damage that the environment was suffering because of the pollution from oil, in the same way that the companies that were selling tobacco were lying about the damage that nicotine did or that asbestos did. And big money will always obfuscate and try and suppress evidence, or worse, will distract by creating junk science and false evidence. And that if there is confusion, it is because the science is there, but you cannot stop the advertising of junk science and pseudoscience that is used to combat it. And I would point the finger at people like Nigel Lawson, who spent more time on, along with Farage, spent more time on Question Time and other things for the lobbies, that were pushing climate change denial than any number of scientists have ever done on mainstream media. Yeah?
Yeah.
So, yes, I'm not at all surprised that your cabbies don't think of it, but I agree with Paul, probably, even if they had a slight twinge that maybe they are contributing to it, it's their job and they don't want to believe. Who does want to believe that their job depends upon something that is harming the environment, particularly when you know that pollution from cars, brain damage as children, causes them, you know, increases their risks of asthma and ill health. And cabbies in particular, I know, are very, very supportive of children's charities and health charities in particular. So it's uncomfortable, shall we say. It's an uncomfortable, not just an inconvenient truth.
Do you want to come in on the point, Grace, before I bring in Ian and Jonathan? Otherwise, there might be too much to remember, that's all.
Yeah, there was something that I missed that was, but the thing about cabbies, they are exceptionally at risk from the pollution from car engines, because when it comes to levels of air pollution, the greatest level is actually inside the vehicle that's being driven. So they're in denial about the danger to their own health, let alone anybody else's.
Yeah, good point.
Ian and Gunnar.
Well, that's a good point, but there's also this susceptibility to populist movements, and some particular social layers like cabbies and such like are notorious for being sort of susceptible to such things, and to urban myths and all sorts of stuff, you know, which are obviously, you know, are quite commonly part of the way that such things spread around, you know. Now, on the other hand, I mean, it's quite common now for cabbies to be driving things like a Prius, which I actually drive, which is a low, it doesn't use much petrol anymore. It's a hybrid that has a very low petrol consumption. So I suppose, you know, basically because it's cheaper to run, you know, that's quite a common phenomenon as well. So they may have some sort of input into this, pushing in another direction. In some cases, if you're talking about the standard black cab, but if you're talking about some of the private hire vehicles, the Prius has become like a workhorse for taxis, and he actually is a low emissions vehicle, and it's very cheap to run. It does about 70 miles to the gallon or something like that, and most of that because it uses up. It charges its own battery and runs on that for a long time, you know. A useful car to have, actually. If you have to have a car, it's better to have that, in my opinion. The full electric ones are a bit more difficult to get your head round at this point. Where I'm concerned, anyway. But yeah, I mean, I think populist movements have an impact on these things, and in general, this climate change denial thing is a product of a populist mood, and it's a product of the failure of the left thus far to put up any real resistance to this crap. And if we get a stronger left, perhaps through the new party that's being formed up, which hopefully will provide opportunities to do that, we can really push back against this rubbish, you know, because it is rubbish. Unfortunately, the Galloway Party has capitulated to aspects of it. And I'm sure there are others on the left who have as well, but particularly him, you know, has gone along with bullshit, basically. Well, there is a problem that some of the measures taken by liberals are to ameliorate pollution, etc., have a certain bias towards, benefiting the better off and not the poor. And they haven't actually done anything serious about, you know, there are a lot of people driving cheap old cars that are very polluted. They can't, because they can't afford a new one, you know. And there's been little in the way of schemes that could exchange them for one or the other, you know, that stuff has been minimal, you know what I mean, you know, help people to upgrade to a better vehicle than some of the terrible smoky old things that are around, you know, I know there
the
are
other one was the other one was gas boilers, wasn't it?
I know there are restrictions, so that's the point, you know, is that it just penalises people for being poor. That does happen in terms of the bourgeois environmental stuff, including some of the stuff in London and that, you know. Salik Khan, it could be a lot better, I tell you, in terms of dealing with people who are very low income and still need to drive. You know, need it there.
Jonathan.
Yeah, I think what Ian was saying, right, the answer lies why people go on about climate change and not match fixing, lies something to do with populist movements. I don't know where and how you look. I'm sure someone has put it together. But you know, I mean, when they say, you know, this just goes to show you, you know, I mean, their vested interests in them not highlighting match fixing. There's huge money involved, and they're vested interests, right? But there's a lot of empirical evidence to say that it's going on. I mean, an absolute disaster for them for the sport of snooker was last year when the guy came back from a match fixing ban. And he went on to win the World Snooker Championship, right? Now, this is a problem. Now how come hardly anyone remarked upon this? How come anyone remarked upon this? That someone who's just come served a ban for match fixing comes on and wins the snooker championship, world championship. You know, and there are a lot of people, it isn't a conspiracy theory. It isn't there are empirical facts. There are websites. There are Twitter accounts called Suspicious Game and Matchfixing.x, which highlight the latest investigations, right? But people don't talk about this, and it's something to do with, Ian says, of the populist movement, and something which doesn't have empirical evidence for it, as far as I'm concerned, is that, you know, is that the evidence with climate change, the evidence they're putting forward. I mean, very few scientists hold that the vast majority have got it wrong, that climate change doesn't exist, right? But on the other hand, but still there's a large proportion of people who believe that they are sceptical of the evidence. Now, how come they're sceptical of that evidence, where the vast majority of climate scientists say there's no doubt? You can disagree on degrees, but there's no doubt this thing. And then when you come to sport, where there is quite a bit of empirical evidence to say that there's much more match fixing goes on than people think, and nobody ever says anything. Now, someone will explain that to me, how one day that works, that the climate change, well, 95% of scientists say, look, we've looked at all the evidence, and the evidence shows that climate change is very real, and we better do something about it, say another 80%. And then you get this sort of movement that says, well, no, it's, you know, we're going to believe the small percentage of scientists who doubt all this, and then we're going to support them. Now, what's going on there? And then you come, and I bring up the example of sporting. And in sporting, you know, I can cite various evidence that people should doubt the result of football matches, box, cricket, tennis thing. There have been life bans handed out to loads of people now, and you don't get in a taxi driver, and I don't believe it's because they drive petrol cars, and I don't get in a taxi and they say to me, what do you think of the match fixing? Now, how that works, I don't know, but they're willing to listen to a small percentage of scientists who go against the vast majority of the scientific community in that area. And in this area, you don't hear a thing.
Jonathan, I have put in the chat, the real problem is so few people in this country really know their maths, probability and statistics, because if they did, they would know that the only way you ever win against the bookies is if you back the favourites, because the bookies don't make as much money on people who bet the favourites as they do on the people who bet outsiders. And max fixing is the way in which they always win. But, you know, your chap who won after a ban, it's because he always knew he could win, which meant it was very easy for him to throw matches and ensure that the bookies made an absolute fortune, while the betting public says, oh, aren't I brilliant? I backed the person who wasn't so ordered, whereas in fact they're making vast amounts of money on far more money on the small loan. And that is a counterintuitive thing that common sense, you know, that infinitely rare capacity that people have to see through the cons. Yeah? And no matter how
I understand why this has been brought up, but I am a bit concerned.
Yeah, that we've gone off topic.
Far away from the environment and suddenly gone into sport. I know why that came up, but that's not really something for Diana or us to deal with.
No, but as Ian says, it's quite right that there is an issue with sort of curmudgeonliness that says, if everybody is saying something, I'm going to say the opposite. Mm-hmm. Yes, or I'm going to believe the opposite.
Yeah. Diana.
Yeah, I find it a bit weird and disturbing, and perhaps it's not weird considering how scientifically ill-educated people are, but why siding with a particular scientist and disagreeing with another particular group of scientists? Isn't it not the scientists you should be looking at? It's the science.
Yep.
The scientists you should be listening to are the ones who are explaining the science. Now, they might explain it, to prove the point, the wrong point, in which case you should be able to look at that and think, oh, that's flawed, or look at this scientific explanation from somebody who's got it right, and then compare the two and see, ah, yes, that's the one that's right. Rather than saying, well, I'm backing this group, or I'm backing this other group. That's not the way to be looking at it, surely.
No. But then we would all be far better educated and able to make up our own minds. And what use for the establishment would we be if we were independently capable of evaluating and judging for ourselves instead of voting the way we're told to once every 5 years? No?
Do not want an educated citizen.
No?
They might start planning revolution. Oh my goodness.
But bloody
Does anyone else want to come in?
I think we should.
I'm aware that one of our participants hasn't spoken.
I don't think there's anybody who hasn't spoken at all, is there?
Yeah, Mark.
Mark C. Yeah.
Okay. I haven't really got much to say on top of what you've said.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
All right, then. So, Ian, you want me to sum up before we turn the recording
off? Yeah, that'll be fine. Yeah, yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Okay, so, so finish off then by saying thank you for coming, comrades, and we'll hopefully see you all being well. There could be a meeting in 2 or 3 weeks' time.
2 weeks' time, probably.
And, yeah. And so those on the mailing list will get the email or messenger message.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully we'll see you in a couple of weeks. And
yeah.
So Ian, you can turn off the recording and then we'll go on to any other business.
And thank you again, Diana.